to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, December 6, 2017. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is Ivy Pakoda. Ivy is the author of the critically acclaimed novels Wonder Valley and Visitation Street. Wonder Valley was a Los Angeles Times Book of the Year. Visitation Street was chosen as an Amazon Best Book of 2013 and a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writer selection. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, the Los Angeles Review of Books, the Huffington Post, Self, and House and Garden. Her first novel, The Art of Disappearing, was published by St. Martin's Press in 2009. She teaches creative writing at the Lamp Arts Studio in Skid Row. Ivy has a BA from Harvard College in Classical Greek and an MFA from Bennington College in Fiction. She grew up in Brooklyn and currently lives in West Adams, Los Angeles, with her husband, Justin Noel, and she's here today to talk about her new novel, Wonder Valley, published by Echo. Hi, Ivy.
Hey, Barbara.
Great to have you back on. We talked last about Visitation Street, which I loved, and I'm so excited to talk to you about this one, too. Wonder Valley, take us into the book and talk about where it began.
Well, the book starts out in a traffic jam in Los Angeles, but my inspiration for writing it was taken from a creative writing class I teach in Skid Row in downtown L.A. So I began teaching creative writing at the Lamp Arts Program, which is a art studio available to people who are dealing with extreme poverty, homelessness, and various mental illnesses. And at the same time, I began to write my book. And some of the stories that I heard from my the writers in my program leaked into my writing, and that was the first kernel of Wonder Valley.
Interesting. So Lamp Arts, I'm so curious about that, how you got involved with it.
Well, I used to live in the Arts District, which is to the east of Skid Row. They border. And I spent a lot of time in downtown L.A., and Skid Row is sort of a it's a neighborhood you have to pass through to get between the Arts District and downtown. So I would pass through Skid Row nearly every day, either on foot, on my bicycle, or in a car. And what initially seemed like a random collection of tents and people camping and falling down on the street really began to reveal itself as an organized community, at least in part. And the more time I spent commuting through Skid Row, the more I wanted to know about it. So I came across a documentary called Lost Angels about Skid Row. And at the end, there was an email to get involved with the program featured in the community. And that was the Lamp Community Center, which is now called the People Concern. And I emailed them, and they asked me to come in and start teaching creative writing nearly immediately. So I have been involved with the Lamp Art Studio for now nearly 5 years. And I teach a weekly creative writing workshop, though I'm not there every week right these days. And we founded a little zine, a magazine that's made by the artists called Skid Row Zine. And we take it to various zine fests around Southern California.
Interesting. Well, I want to talk more about that later and talk more about teaching later. But about Wonder Valley, I am curious, well, about so much, but you have alternating points of view. You write it with alternating points of view. And I'm curious why, and if the various characters, Ren, Britt, Blake, all your characters, if they found their way into the story after you began the novel, or did you have it pretty much scoped out before you began?
You know, one of the reasons I write my multi-perspective books, I think, is that, because Visitation Street was as well, is that it's two reasons. First of all, I don't really have the entire story in my mind when I sit down to write, and the first thing that occurs to me is to write about a place. And in order to explore a place, it's really good to have all different sets of eyes on it. So the more characters you have, the more of a panorama you can create. A place isn't just the way I see it. It's the way you see it. It's the way someone else sees it. It's the way a young person sees it. An old person sees it. So I think multi-perspective novels really help me examine a place and a community, which is what I really love to write about. But also because I have no idea where I'm going, when I run to the end of a chapter with one character, I can hop on over to another and toggle back and forth until I find my story. So one reason is to, you know, create this panorama of community, but the other is sort of to, you know, take a shortcut or to cheat myself out of having to figure out what's going on until it becomes a lot later in the book. And I have to, you know, struggle to put it all together, all these voices.
So then what you begin with, you said it sort of emerged out of teaching your class. Can you talk a little bit more about that kernel or what got you going and how you knew you had to do something with it that would be a novel and not a short story, not an essay, not something shorter?
Well, I don't really write short stories, so I'm not really, it's not a form I'm very comfortable with. And, you know, before I started teaching my class, I had started working on a novel, or what I was hoping would become a novel, about people who live in camper vans in Echo Park, which is the neighborhood I'd lived in previously. And I was very interested in the fact that in this sort of, you know, gentrifying hipster neighborhood, people were living in campers on the street. And I come from New York City, and that just doesn't seem, although people are, homelessness, although it is a huge problem in New York, isn't as visible. Possibly because the weather is colder. So I'd seen these people living in this community in camper vans, and I was like, well, that's fascinating. It seems very California to me. And when I started teaching my class, I immediately realized that this is really the story I was trying to tell wasn't about that very small subset of, like, off-the-grid living, but it was very much directly with this larger issue of homelessness. And I didn't want to report on it. I mean, there's so much reporting on homelessness. There's, you know, dedicated people at the LA Times and KCRW, our local radio station, who report on homelessness and homeless condition. What I wanted to do was really talk about the stories. Everyone who's homeless, the only thing they have or who's formerly struggled with homelessness, is the one thing you can't take away from somebody is his or her story. It's a thing that belongs to him or her uniquely. And no one's story begins on Skid Row. For the most part, people, something bad happens or an unfortunate circumstance, series of events, land you living downtown. So I was really interested in figuring out a way to honor the people that I was working with in the studio by telling the stories that, you know, were not entirely to do with the bad times in Skid Row, but how they got there, who they were as people before and after and during this time. So I felt fiction was the greatest way to bring the spirit and the joy that can still be found in these desperate circumstances to life.
Interesting. I'd love to hear you read. Would you read from Wonder Valley?
Of course. I'll read from the beginning because okay. It is a multi-perspective novel, and it's really hard to introduce parts in the middle. Los Angeles, 2010. He is almost beautiful, running with the San Gabriels over one shoulder, the rise of the Hollywood Freeway as it arcs above the Pasadena Freeway over the other. He is shirtless, the hint of swimmer's muscle rippling below his tan skin, his arms pumping in a 1-2 rhythm in sync with the beat of his feet. There's a chance you envy him. 7 a.m. and traffic is already jammed through downtown, ground to a standstill as cars attempt to cross 5 lanes, moving in increments so small their progress is nearly invisible. They merge in jerks and starts from the Pasadena Freeway onto the Hollywood or the Santa Ana, but he is flowing freely, reverse commuting through the stalled vehicles. The drivers watch from behind their steering wheels, distracted from toggling between radio stations, fixing their makeup in the rear view, talking to friends back east for whom the day is fully formed. They left home early, hoping to avoid the bumper-to-bumper, the inevitable slowdown of their mornings. They've mastered their mathematical calculations, the distance times rate times time of the trip to work. Yet they are stuck. In the city of drivers, he is a rebuke. He runs unburdened by the hundreds of sacrifices these commuters have made to arrive at this traffic jam on time. The breakfast missed, the children unseen, the husband abandoned in bed, the night cut short on account of the early morning, the weak gas station coffee, the unpleasant carpool, the sleep lost, the hasty shower, last night's clothes, last night's makeup. He ignores the commuters sealed off in their climate-controlled cars, trapped in the first news cycle in the wheel of Top 40. He holds a straight line through the morning's small desperations, the problems waiting to unfold, the desire to be elsewhere, to be anywhere but here today and tomorrow, and all the mornings that run together into one citywide tangle of freeways and on-ramp closures and sig alerts. The whole day narrowed to the stop and go. His expression is mid-marathon serene, focused on the goal and yet not overwhelmed by the distance. He shows no strain. But the woman in the battered soft-top convertible will say he looked drugged. The man in a souped-up hatchback claims he was crazy high, totally loco, you know what I mean. A couple of teenage girls driving an SUV way beyond their pay grade insist that, although they barely noticed him, he looked like a superhero, but not one of the cool ones.
Thank you so much. That was Ivy Pakoda reading from Wonder Valley, published by Echo. Now, tell me why you began with the naked man running down the 101.
Well, he's actually running down the 110. Everyone gets it wrong.
Okay.
Someone's going to fight. Even the LA Times got it wrong. I should point it out. For several reasons, when you're writing a multi-perspective novel, you need something that draws everybody's focus. And traffic is this great equalizer in LA. No matter who you are, rich, poor, what race you are, young, old, everyone has to deal with traffic. And everyone talks about it. And it's the sort of thing, though I'm blessed enough to not actually have to deal with traffic because I work from home, although I take my daughter to school now, so I'm kind of getting a sense of it. It's this thing that starts off everybody's day at the same rate, in the same way. How are we going to get to work? How long is it going to take? And everyone at this one, in this one thing is paying attention, in this one instance is paying attention to the same thing. We're all paying attention, hopefully, to driving, to the commute, to the freeways. And suddenly, it's a moment where the whole city is drawn together. And I was sort of fascinated with the idea of an incident in the morning traffic, which, in L.A., people listen to the news. They watch the local news. I mean, New York, we don't watch the local news in the morning as much. But in L.A., the news is always on, and the traffic reports are always on. So an incident in traffic really affects the entire city. Everyone's talking about it. Everyone's listening to it. I mean, right now, for instance, with the fires burning, the 405 is closed. It's mm-hmm. Everyone is thinking about the same thing, So I wanted to use that and exploit it and create an incident that wasn't, as dramatic as a fire forcing evacuation, but something that passed through everyone's radar and that would have repercussions for all of my characters. So I thought of the naked man running through traffic, which is based on something that I remember reading about as a kid, where a naked man who was a friend of a friend ran across the Brooklyn Bridge naked, and everyone was talking about it in Brooklyn. So that was the sort of the fictional genesis of turning that into, fiction, but also the traffic as sort of a way to coalesce the entire city around one incident.
Was that always the beginning?
It's funny. No, it wasn't. I mean, I can never remember. There have been so many drafts. It's always the beginning in the sense of that's the beginning when I realized this was my book. I put that at the beginning, but no, I didn't begin there. I began with someone sort of picking pockets on Skid Row. God only knows what happened to that story. It's not in there anymore.
Well, that brings up another interesting point, and that is how much you leave out, in the revision process. I mean, how similar does this look to your original draft, or how dissimilar does it look?
It's funny. So with Visitation Street, my previous novel, the draft that I submitted to my editor that she, acquired is, for the most part, you could exchange it with the draft that was published. The draft of this book that I submitted to my publisher and the one that were published are significantly different in scope. It was way too long. I wrote so much, and there were just, as the book toggles between the desert and downtown L.A., there were just lots of scenes in the desert where nothing was happening, but I was sort of transfixed by this life in this commune in the desert, and also same with Skid Row, just a lot of hanging out and scene setting. And so a lot of it got scalpeled away, which really brought the characters to the fore a little bit more, and they started to shine. So I did a lot of work on this book. The core idea was always there, but it went on a major diet between submission and publication.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. So one thing I noticed, that I loved about Visitation Street, and that I so much like that's happening in this book, is setting. You have so much setting, so much landscape, and it always tends to be, if I like the setting, it tends to be one of my favorite things about a book. there's so much desert, there's so much LA, there's so much Southern California, really. So I was curious if you take notes when you're out and about, or do you see what settles in, what setting you end up writing because it remains in your brain or in your mind, or when you think about a place, you think about that place?
Definitely the latter. I mean, I don't take notes, you know, oh, I need to check out those crows. I need to write about them. You know, it's pretty cool. It's definitely because then it hasn't stayed with me. It's definitely what exactly the way you phrased it is, if it sticks in your mind, it seems important enough to write about it. And I don't want to force that by, I need to remember, you know, this detail. If the detail has stuck with me, it's definitely going to be the thing I want to write about. So I do, you know, the desert, I stayed out there for 6 weeks when I first began to write the book, and I had no intention of writing about the desert. I was writing about L.A. and people who live off the grid in L.A., but living in the desert out in 29 Palms, that, you know, suddenly I realized, well, people are writing about people living off the grid in L.A. I mean, it's the exact same thing out here. You know, you see people wandering down these highways in the desert with the backpacks on, and there's like nothing out there, and you're wondering where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And I realized that sort of transience was very similar to certain people who live in Skid Row. Not everybody, because, you know, some people are in Skid Row by necessity. Some people are there not entirely by choice, but who have chosen to live a different lifestyle. And people in the desert also have sort of chosen not to engage with the contemporary world in a certain way. So the setting just spoke to me, and I had to move part of my story there. So I'm not sure, actually, I didn't take notes, but I was writing about the desert while I was there. And then when I came home, you know, I had enough material to remember what it was like. I kept going back out there. But it was so visceral living there that it just leaked into my story.
Mm-hmm. Well, likewise, your titles always have something to do with place. I mean, even The Art of Disappearing is really, to me, about place and Visitation Street and Wonder Valley. And so how important is place? I mean, I sense that it's very important, but...
Yeah, I'm just having this fantasy. I'm looking at my bookshelf now that, like, one day I'll like 8 books and they're all a different place. They all have like similar bindings. I'll be like, I've had a good career. I love place. It's as I said, either here or everywhere I speak to people about my book, it's the first thing that occurs to me. I think at first it was out of a sense of laziness or a sense of not knowing how to write character and story. Place, I've always been I have a good facility with description. So place was, The Art of Disappearing, which is set in Las Vegas and Amsterdam, I could describe those places forever. And then I've defined characters that sort of, you know, make it a story, and then a story that makes the characters interesting. But that sort of, you know, early stab at writing and using place as a crutch to sort of anchor the story really developed into a sense of writing about a community as a way to, you know, so both Wonder Valley and Visitation Street are about community and place. And it's just the thing that I love to write about. I think that, you know, I love to look out the window and describe what's going on in the street, and then all the people involved in it and all the, you know, different, for the most part, no place is what appears on the surface. There are always things hidden underneath it, and I just find that sort of fascinating to either investigate or to make up if it's not as interesting as I'd hoped.
Mm. Yeah, and, you know, as you say, you have such a facility with description. I loved, early on in the book, there's a flash flood scene, and I'm like, well, has she been a flash flood? Because this is what it seems like it would be, but you know, who has actually been in one? And that was such a great scene.
Oh, thanks. I have not been in a flash flood, but the beauty of YouTube is that I could watch a lot of flash floods. And when I was living out in 29 Palms, there was a sign that kept, you know, on the highway. It's in the desert, and it says, warning, flash flood area. And it just seems completely beyond all reason that this dry, desiccated land, where there is no water in sight, none, could flood. And so I thought, well, that's pretty interesting, you know, what would that look like? And then you look on YouTube and it's like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. You know, it comes like storming in like galloping horses, and suddenly the highway is, you know, overtaken by water. So, I mean, I feel that it is a bit of a cheat to look at it on YouTube, but close enough.
Yeah, close enough, because, you know, who knows if you're caught in one, right? I mean,
yeah, exactly.
It's not
you can't
good.
Always. I can't go around waiting for a flash flood. It's just not going
to
happen.
Yeah, yeah. And the characters that this happens to, it's not so good for them. So
no, not really.
You don't want to get caught in it.
Nope.
So, well, you know, again, along these lines, your writing is so visual and tactile. And does this happen early on in the writing then? I mean, you said you have a facility for description. And is this one of the things that comes early that you don't have to work that hard at? And if so, then what are the things you have to work hard at?
Yeah, the description is, for me, the easy part. I mean, nothing's easy, but that's the part I could do for hours. The hard part for me is, the interesting, I really struggle with describing people. Places are really easy, but I find, like, even when I read novels and of terrific writers who write great descriptions of human beings, I have trouble envisioning the people. So it's very hard for me to, like, write characteristics of, you know, physical characteristics. It's really difficult. It always seems a little forced. But the hardest thing for me is really to sort of find the line between having too much plot, making too many things happen just to have a story, and I tend to shy away from a lot of story, and then I wind up cramming all the story and all these things happening very quickly. So that balance is so hard to strike. I mean, so I really struggle to find the plot that's going to satisfy my place, and to bring it to life with, like, that balance of, you know, a slow burn, not like a torrent of activity.
Well, you know, back to the flash flood scene, there was a little thing. One of your characters, I think the one that who broke his foot during the flash flood. Sam. Yeah, he squeezes water out of his braid. I think. Mm-hmm. It's he that does that. And I found that such a wonderful little telling detail that told me just a lot about him.
It's funny, Sam, of all the characters I've ever created, Sam was the most visually apparent to me of anybody. I can see him immediately, and Blake, too. Those two people, I knew exactly what they looked like. And it's funny that you picked that out, because he was physical. I could envision him, and, you know, it was a huge difference to be able to write someone who was so easy to envision. With that long black braid, and he's large, and he's, you know, he looks possibly Mexican, but not really. So it just all seemed, he lived in my mind's eye very clearly, concretely.
Yeah. Totally in mind, too. But I'm curious, you know, especially newish writers, and especially women, seem to feel inhibited about writing about the opposite gender. You do it quite well. And I'm curious about that, if you've ever sort of been inhibited, or your approach, or when students, you know, bring this concern to you, what do you say?
Well, for some reason, and I have no idea why this is, I have a much easier time writing about men. I think for me, it's always a little bit freeing to write about the thing I'm more far away from, less close to. For me, when I write about something that I'm really close to, you know, there's this panic. Am I getting it right? You know, am I getting it right? This is I'm a woman. This is how I feel. Is it coming across? Whereas when I write about a man, I'm making it up. So it's like I can't be told I'm getting it wrong because I made it up. I don't know why. It's always been something that's come a little easier to me. Not that writing comes easily, but it doesn't. But for my students, you know, I would tell them never to shy away from writing the opposite gender. I think it's really interesting. And often I tell them, too, you know, if you're struggling with the scene, write it from the other person's perspective. Mm-hmm. And what I notice a lot with beginning writers is this sense of writing characters that are way too close to themselves. And this panic, as I just mentioned, of not getting it right. Like, this is how it really happened. Like, I did go to that college in New Jersey, and the lunchroom was like this, and that's what he talked about. And, you know, it was like this. And I said, well, the idea, there's this panic of not getting it across, and then you sacrifice story, you sacrifice movement, you know, you sacrifice atmosphere because this panic of this clenched fistedness of like convincing us how it really happened. And so I always tell people, take a step back. Don't write so close to yourself. But if that means writing from the male character, please try that.
So will you run those scenes by, I don't know, your husband, other writers, other men?
Write
them? No?
No, I mean, you know, it's a little trickier when it's a different race is something that I felt a little more, you know, anxious about because I do write about a great deal of African-American characters in this book. And, you know, I will sort of check in with people who are, you know, not white like me to see whether I've overstepped or done anything. But in terms of gender, no, it doesn't really bother me.
I love that. And on that note, we're going to take a real quick break. All of you out there, stay with us. We'll be right back with more Ivy Pakoda. Don't go anywhere.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. You can find past shows on iTunes. You can go to iTunes, search out Writers on Writing. If you have trouble, search out Pen on Fire. Somehow it will come up. And if you subscribe, you will receive notification every time we upload a show. This one should go up in the next week or so. And what else can I tell you? Oh, I should say that the opinions and views that you hear on the show are not those of the University of California Regents, but those of me, my guest. And Ivy Pakoda will be at the Pen on Fire speaker series February 6th. If you want more info on that, you're going to be in Orange County and you want to come, and I know you do, go to penonfire.com and click on speaker series and you'll find out more info. Let's bring her back on. Hey, Ivy.
Hey, Barbara.
Hi. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your being a squash player, you being an athlete, and how that has influenced your writing.
Well, I played and competed and coached squash throughout the writing of my first two books. And it worked as a very nice juxtaposition for the hours spent in front of my computer, just simply being able to go out and exercise. And, the practices seem to be quite different. One is physical and the other is cerebral, although, squash is a sort of mentally challenging game and involves a lot of thinking and strategy. But both of them, being a squash player, or an athlete of any sort, you only have yourself to rely on, and you only have yourself to blame for not putting in the hours and the effort which show up in competition. So, it taught me a great deal of self-discipline. You get up in the morning at 6 and get to training, or really 7, 6 a little early, get to training and, work hard, because if you show up at the tournament and you haven't trained, you feel pretty awful. And so it gave me a great deal of self-discipline, but it also, provided this interesting complement to writing, because, I got to exercise different muscles in the two different activities. But one of the reasons I started writing was it's not that I didn't thoroughly enjoy playing squash, but I felt that it was sort of leaving a part of my personality or my interests, unexplored, and I wanted to do something different. So I started to write The Art of Disappearing as a way to excuse all the hours I was devoted to being a jock, and so it really worked out. Also there is some kind of overlap, I think, in the squash and writing, which is you have to have a pretty big toolkit to do both. You can't just hit the ball super hard and expect to win, or you can't play this long, boring, attritional game and expect to win. And just the same with writing. You can't just write character. You can't just write, description. You have to be able to do a whole bunch of other things. So they really have informed each other a lot in my life.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think I know any other writers who are squash players.
I can name a few.
But that's great, because the whole idea of discipline, it's probably what we suffer from most, right? It's being able to sit in the chair, discipline ourselves to be in the chair, stay there, and not get up when we feel like getting up. It's hard.
It absolutely is. Sometimes I envy people who have a job where it's sort of much more regimented. It's both freeing and frustrating.
Yeah. Well, you have said, I don't know what interview it was that I read, that you said you don't particularly like the genre of noir, and yet your fiction is often described as noir. So what do you think about that? How do you sort of reconcile not being a particular reader of noir, and yet you're often talked about as a noir writer?
I know. It's not that I don't like it. It's just not a genre that, I've read all the classics you do growing up. I've read some Chandler and whatever, and I've read, what else? I've read Ross McDonald, but I didn't study it. I read those and I read a million other books, and it never jumped out at me like, I need to write that. I never set out to write crime or mystery, and I sort of don't think that I do. I write about a place, and I write about a community, and a really great way to examine a place or a community is having a crisis, and that's often a crime. Sometimes it's a natural disaster, or an apocalypse. But I'm tickled by it, and I'm absolutely flattered, especially living in California, where noir is like the thing, and people are so into it, and passionate about it, and interesting when they speak about it. So I'm completely flattered. I think if you told me go write a noir novel, I would fail miserably. Like, I'm like, oh God, this is very stressful. You know, I don't know exactly how to do it. But I think, you know, I like to write about things that are a little suspicious and below the things that live like below the surface. And also, you know, the people who live in the shadows and who live off the grid, and that does create a sort of noir feeling in my fiction. Also, writing about downtown L.A., I think, really sort of upped the noir factor because, you know, Bunker Hill, which is just near Skid Row, is where a lot of those noir Marlowe novels were set. So accidentally, I stumbled on a place that sort of suited this genre I was being, you know, mentioned as a writer of. So you know, it's fascinating to me, you know, to be categorized as a noir writer, and I do understand why it happens, but it's not something I've intentionally ever decided to try out.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think of you more as, I don't know, a writer of literary fiction. And
that's what I think, but...
Yeah, yeah, I mean, language is important in your books, and you know, there's just so much beautiful phrasing and interesting writing that, you know, it's and it's also interesting that California, as you say, is, you know, we're thought of as, you know, the originators of noir, and yet it's such a sunny, happy place, right?
Well, true, but yes, absolutely. But also, there's a sense that like the sunlight is kind of deceptive and it makes people crazy, and like all of this is deceptively beautiful and it's deceptively sunny. I mean, there's so many crazy things that happen in California under the bright sun, and I think, you know, from my rather recent crash course in noir, like noir is like the is sort of the juxtaposition of light and shadow, and we have that in California. There's a bright sun, but it casts these really dark shadows.
Mm-hmm. Well, who've been your influences
in my writing? Let's see, you know, gosh, I really have always sort of looked up to Don DeLillo and Jonathan Lethem, who kind of write these, well, at least Jonathan's novel, Fortress of Solitude, really is this panorama of my neighborhood in Brooklyn. We grew up in the same neighborhood. And when I read that book, I was just blown away because I thought, well, I thought books had to be fantastic and wildly imagined. This book is fantastically imagined, but like I thought it'd be fantasy and, you know, and just to read a book that had some sort of magical realism elements, but really was about my neighborhood. Your book didn't have to leave my home street. It just kind of changed my whole thinking about writing. I didn't have to make stuff up. It was out the window. It was out there. And I just love Don DeLillo's Underworld. I mean, you know, it's just, for me, a book that I could never imagine writing a book like that, but I certainly enjoy reading it. I like, you know, those two writers. And the other book that I always turn to in terms of story is Dan Shaun's Await Your Reply. The wildness of those three intersecting stories and just the daring with which he put them together, I find really inspirational. I do like a lot of female writers, too. It's just when people ask me this question, those are the three people whose books I've always turned to. I'm going to have to figure out a new way to answer it because it is getting a little tricky. But it just happens to be three male writers. It's not because they're men. Oh, and the fourth book that I've always been, that inspires me, yet another male writer, is again, this book inspires me because, like Don DeLillo's book, I could never imagine writing it, and I'm so in awe of it, is Tree of Smoke by Dennis Johnson. The sort of the wild abandon which he approaches the story of Vietnam and you know, how it gets down to this micro level, and then it examines the whole, you know, war panorama. It's just fascinating to me. So those books are the four that I sort of look to and say, one day maybe I can do this.
Well, what about the move from New York to Los Angeles? What how did it affect your writing, or did it?
It's interesting. I was thinking about this the other day. I was still writing Visitation Street, which is about the neighborhood I was living in Brooklyn, which is near the neighborhood where I grew up, when I moved to LA. And it felt like I wasn't actually leaving home in a certain way, like I was clinging on so tight, and I was still working on this book. And I didn't really let go of New York until that book came out, and I talked about Brooklyn all the time, and I went back to Brooklyn, and I read in Brooklyn. And then, you know, because, as I've said, place is the most important thing to me when I write, and I have to be sort of entrenched or really know a place before I feel comfortable writing about it. I wasn't going to write another Brooklyn book, and I'd been living in L.A. for 5 years, And so I thought, oh my gosh, I have to write a book in LA, and that's such a terrifying prospect because, you know, there's this huge conversation about who writes LA best. You know, is it Joan Didion? Is it Nathaniel West? Is it Walter Mosley? Is it Michael Connelly? And I said, I can't believe I'm dipping my toe into that water, or, like, you know, putting my neck on that guillotine. But I felt that I had to do it because I have to. It's so much easier for me and to write about a place where I physically living. So I had to become an LA writer, which was incredibly nerve-wracking, but I'm so flattered that, you know, my book is being lauded as a book that gets LA or does LA justice. So that's the thing. I couldn't hope for anything else. So yeah, I guess I'm an LA writer, at least for the moment.
Yeah, and on the cover, you have a wonderful Michael Connelly blurb. He says, destined to be a classic LA novel. That's pretty cool.
Well, from his lips. So, yeah.
From his lips. Yeah, because I was curious about that because, you hear writers talk a lot about having to leave a place to be able to see it and write about it. And you're just the opposite, which I love. You know, you're in a place that you're writing about.
Yeah, I don't know why that's the case. I mean, I understand writing, having to finish an experience before writing about it. I don't understand, not that it's not a valid exercise or something that other people can do, writing a memoir while you're still experiencing that, or like only a year after. I feel like an experience has to sort of sink in, but a place, it's so great to write about a place where you are because you can sort of explore it and, you know, check it out and new things occur to you and appear to you. And that's, I mean, I love living in the place I'm writing about.
Mm. We have a few minutes left. I'm with Ivy Pakoda. Her novel that we've been talking about is Wonder Valley, published by Echo. Let's circle back around to teaching. And I'm curious, how do you teach writing?
Well, I'm probably the most ill-focused writing teacher in the world. I really like to give in my workshops, I love to talk about people's work. And I think that one of the things that writers really struggle with is how to talk about his or her their work. You know, and I think that the more people can talk about what they're writing and articulate it, everyone can talk about it, but it's like to make sense of what you're doing is the first step to being able to write well. So I really encourage my students to be able to describe their work and to have the confidence to really say what it is. And I feel like there's so many people who try to write or do write, but they're nervous or they're unsure. And I just try to encourage my students to really describe their story. And often in describing the story, they find out what they're writing is not the story they're describing, or what they're describing is not the story they're writing. So I teach a workshop called The Novel from Beginning to End, or I used to teach it for Writing Workshops LA. And it was just a forum where people can really sort of talk their books through and, you know, believe in their book as something that's going to be finished, but also in the discussion of it, find the story.
Do you think you have to be able to have that elevator pitch or have that paragraph that kind of sums it up to actually pull it off? You know, I mean, it seems like that's the thing.
You know, I don't think you have to do that to sell your book. For no commercial reasons, you have to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And I would have said about five years ago, no, that's ridiculous. You don't have to be able to do that. And when I would talk about Visitation Street, I came across as sort of unknowledgeable about my own work because I felt that activity, that skill was unimportant. But then I realized, you know, you really do need to be able to describe your work. You know, you do really, because then it's clear in your own head. You don't need to do it to, like, sell it to an agent or an editor, though mm-hmm. obviously that's helpful. But, you know, if you can describe it, then you know what you're writing about. And I think it is important for your own sake. You know, and I really do encourage people to say, you know, I'm writing a book about this, and this is what it is. Because so many people feel like they'll describe something that's not the book they're writing, and then how could you be writing this book if you can't describe, you know, if you don't know its core essence?
Yeah.
Often you can't describe it till you're done, or you're halfway through, which is also okay.
Right, right. Or as you write, it comes more into focus, and as you
right.
go through it, yeah.
It changes, yeah.
So can you remember anything from when you were a student that was especially helpful or instructive to you that you continue to remember? That maybe came from, I don't know, a professor, a writing teacher, maybe another student?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I went to graduate school at Bennington, and I learned so many different things. A lot of them are craft-oriented, just about the nuts and bolts of writing. But one of the things, I think I attribute this to myself, but I think I probably heard it from somebody else, is I always tell everybody to write the book you want to read, not the book people you think people want to read. And I think there's a sense that, like, a certain type of fiction is selling, or a certain type of fiction is interesting, or a certain type of fiction is important, but maybe that's not what you want to read, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think if you write the book that you think is, not the book you think is missing from the great American canon or the mystery that no one's written before, but the book that you want to pick up from your nightstand or the book that you're going to grab off the bookshelf, that's the book that's going to, you're going to do your best job of writing. Mm. And that's the only, I think that's the most important thing you can hold on to when you're writing.
So, you know, I asked you earlier if you run the male parts by men, but what about just your work in general? At what point do you show readers? Do you show readers? Do you just send it directly to your agent or editor? How do you go about that?
I'm really private about my work. I rarely talk about it. Even my writer friends say, yeah, they're like, I shouldn't ask you about what you're doing. I'm like, no, you know, I don't talk about it at all. And I feel like too many voices really make me nervous and make me second guess myself. And not that anything I write is perfect, but I have to get that first version on paper in my own, with my own vision alone. And the first person I show my work to is my mom. She is an editor, mostly of long form journalism, not fiction, but she's a really good eye. And my father also worked in publishing. So my parents are my readers, but that's at a much later stage. And then it goes from them to my agent. And my agent had an assistant who's now an agent at our agency, Inkwell, himself. And he's one of my favorite readers. So I don't have very many readers, about three or four people. And, you know, it's often at a later stage. I feel like I really have to dig into the trenches, my stick in myself, before getting outside help.
Have you always been this way?
Yes. I was told that it was a fault of mine because maybe I should be more open to other people's advice and I would learn something. But I think I'm not at all adverse to criticism and I'm not all adverse to rewriting and getting, you know, notes from people. But that first draft is mine and mine alone. And I did do a little reading group, or what do you call it, a writing group for the first couple chapters of what became Wonder Valley. And I just remember some of the comments and just thinking, this is so ridiculous. You know, why are we, it's very hard to workshop a novel, too, because you can't get the whole, you know, the whole story. And people just tend to, like, at least in my opinion, like, focus on the, you know, I describe a hawk beating its wings like a bass drum. And I remember getting this whole conversation with this woman about, is there such a thing as a bass drum? Is that possible? You know, how could this guy shoot that hawk? I was like, you know, that's not the point. There's going to be 350 more pages. Let's not worry about that. So, no, I don't share my work.
Not even with your husband?
No, not at all. He writes TV and film, and novels are very different. So, I don't really share it with him.
No, I think that's great. I mean, I'm always sort of cautioning students to not share work with those closest to them because, you know,
great advice.
Might be a little too influential.
And also you have a personal relationship with somebody, but that doesn't mean he or she is right about your work. And, you know, there's this weird sense that you, because you are close to them, you have to honor their suggestions. Not that they're always right or wrong, but I feel that sort of muddies the waters and makes you not see quite as clearly.
Hmm. We are at the end of our time. We get to talk more in February when you come down to Newport. But in closing, do you have any last words for the listeners who are mostly writers working on projects and battling through?
I think the only thing that everyone needs to think about is to have blind confidence. You know, if you second guess what you're doing, there's no point in doing it. And to write a novel or to write a short story is a work of ego, and to trick yourself into believing it's going to be finished, it's going to be read, it's going to be done, to really believe not that it's going to be the best thing ever written, but that it's going to find a readers and an audience and that you're going to finish it, is the only thing that should motivate you day in and day out.
Love that. Thank you. Thank you for coming back, Barbara. Yeah, we'll talk more in a couple of months.
Yeah, I can't wait to come down.
Thanks. That was Ivy Pakoda. Her book is Wonder Valley, published by Echo. And she's going to be here soon, and that's going to be a great thing. So go to penonfire.com and click on Speaker Series. You can find out more. I'm going to leave you. I hope you have a good, prosperous week writing. Remember to stay in the chair. It becomes especially difficult around the holidays. But you need to keep that momentum going, right? So come back next week. Marie will be here with a wonderful author. Thanks for listening.